Welcome to Grief Is My Side Hustle. I am ecstatic. This is the highlight of my week because I'm sitting down with someone. As many people know, I like to stalk people on the internet and convince them to be my friends. But I have been quote unquote friends with Jane L. Rosen, who is here with me today for longer than she knows because I've been reading her books as they have been coming out. And I am just so completely honored to have you here to talk to today.
I am completely honored to be here. Thank you, Megan.
I want to jump right in. We're talking about On Fire Island today. And I'm saying that to qualify because you have been prolifically writing. You have books coming out and books coming out. You've already written a book that's coming out after On Fire Island. But I want to talk to you about this book because, as people know with this podcast, we talk a lot about how the world processes grief and loss. And this beautiful story is at its heart really a recovery story, really a story of an entire community learning how to live with multiple losses. It's not just the death of a character, but it's also the breakups of marriages, it's aging, it's the loss of expectations. So what I normally ask people as my first question is, how do you come into the world of grief and loss? So I'm going to put that one out there and just say also, you can talk about that. Another way to pose that would be, how did you decide to frame this book to be about us a loss story in the way that it is?
Okay, those are really two different questions.
Yeah.
Okay, so the first one, how do I come about writing about grief and loss, is because unfortunately I've had tremendous experience. You could probably tell that it was like an insider's view death, unfortunately. But I lost my dad when I was 11. I lost my sister when I was 25. And those two losses at a young age really prepared me for writing a book where the person who is deceased lives on. Because at 11, and even at 25, if I would have stopped speaking to my dad or feeling my dad's presence or speaking to my sister and not feeling her presence, I think my life would have been very sad. It would have continued. The pain would have continued. And I learned how to deal with it in a way where I still feel them around me. And that is what I took into this book in terms of healing from a loss. That's what I took. And the reason that the narrator is dead, to answer the second version of the question, is because I write for women, and I first wrote this story years ago as a screenplay about three men dealing with change and loss. Wow. And when I was adopting it to a novel, my editor said, "You write for women, and this is from male perspectives." So I took the narrator of the wife that had just passed away, a 37-year-old woman, and she became the narrator in the book, which was a bold move.
Yeah.
Because you don't want to be on a depressing book, but I did my damnedest to make it never depressing and just moving and funny and sad, but in a hopeful way.
It reminds me of when people talk about like women in comedy. Women are supposed to have so many roles that also adding funny into that is something that people say, oh, it's going to be done with a knife's edge. I think about grief and loss in a book that has a hopeful levity to it as also like a knife's edge, like a little bit of, it looks easy, but it's so hard. The way in which the story unfolds, there's no errant or extra details. You're getting the plot line as told by a woman who's coming from her own funeral and her friends and family. And the other character that's inside it is the community that she comes from. So can you talk a little bit about, again, the book is called On Fire Island, and we learned about the plot twist, or not twist, but the full circle element.
Me too.
The full circle element of it at the end of the story. But can you just talk about how you thought of the characters, how you brought them into the story, and why the island?
Okay, so why the island is why the characters, it's all one and the same.
Yeah.
I've been living on Fire Island in the summertime for, I guess, 30 years, I would say. I met my husband out there. I raised my children there. It's the antithesis of the city. It's just two different worlds, and it was a wonderful place. I live across the street from a baseball field. So my husband plays baseball. I play baseball. My kids played Little League. I was at that field all the time witnessing the men playing. A lot of sitting on the sidelines watching the men play their game and listening to them and hearing the funny things that came out of their mouths and watching them go from one summer to the next when things happened over the winter and their lives were maybe changed, but they came back to this game and this place that was always the same in many ways. And it just felt like the natural setting, best setting for a book on community and friendship and loss. So that's how I came to the place. And that's how I came to some of the characters.
So what is that like to have a real life place that you write about in a fictionalized way? Is there a real Ben in your mind? Is there a real Shep in your mind? Do they exist? Are your neighbors no longer speaking to you? Has there been a large uptick in looking into real estate? I definitely looked it right up and was like, wait a second, this is a spit of land. I want to know more about it. What is that like to write about your community, but to not be trying to tell the truth about some specific story?
I got a lot of, I think I'm in this book, or who is this one? Who is that one? My friends got phone calls. Who is this one? Who is that one? And everyone was instructed to say, they're no one. They're made up in Jane's head, which they are. But the intergenerational friendships that are on the island and the older men on the island, it's like Shep is a compilation of all of these men who, oddly, I spend a lot of time with, because it's just the way of the land. And there was a man when I first bought the house, and I was so young, and I used to come in every Saturday and Sunday morning and ask for a wet paper towel, walk right into my living room to wash off the scoreboard for the baseball field.
Oh my God.
But as if he was invited. Like, it was hysterical. I'd be in like,
he was doing his job. This is good to do.
He didn't knock on the door. He just walked in. I could be in my pajamas. I was in my pajamas. It was 8:15 in the morning, but it became a funny thing. After a couple of weeks, I'm like, would you like a cup of coffee? And I became very close to him. I did the eulogy at his funeral eventually. So the character of Shep, who's the oldest man in the novel, is definitely made up of a bunch of different characters, but no one specific. And yes, everyone came up to me and said, he's this, he's that. The other two characters, I don't have anyone exactly for them, but I will say that I have friends who are 16 on Fire Island because it's so intergenerational. And so those boys are maybe a compilation of Matt, or Matt is a compilation of them. So it's not based on any one person, but it's based on everybody. And then of course, Julia, my sister, passed away when my sister was 39 of cancer. So I did take a lot of her feelings about dying and a lot of her experience and put it into the book.
What was that like? Was that a sad process? Was that a joyful process?
It's been a long time since my sister has passed, actually. I don't think it was either sad nor joyful. I just had that base, which is an unbelievable thing to have when you write a character. Of course, I'd rather have not had it, but I did have it. It was just helpful. I'll say that. It was just very helpful.
I want to say this just for the folks who haven't yet read the book and are ordering it right now, that it's just to make it clear that the story is told by this young woman who has died of cancer. And she is going back to her community with her husband, who literally he doesn't do Shiva. He opts out. because it's not right. It's not right for him. And he goes back to their community where they were in love, not just with each other, but also with this town and this place that they belong to. And you come right in with this character, Shep. And I don't want to spoil it for people because it's just, he makes the best character entrance of ever. But I grew up in a small town in Cape Cod where there was also tragedy in my life as a child, which does bond people. And so there was something about the intergenerational way of people caring. The narrator is, of course, observing because she's not alive, but she's also observing in the way that an adult observes teenagers, right? You're watching their relationships form and who they're becoming and how they change from summer to summer. She's watching her friend's, dear friend's relationship change and her friends come into her own in a way that's different that she's not there for. But I think there is something about the world of grief and loss and the kind of support that we need that you write about with the whiz. It doesn't feel like this is an idea that I have of how support should be. It feels like this is how I have felt loved and supported by a community. So I wanted to ask particularly about the way the men support each other. There is a scene where they're trying to get a baseball game going and two of the men won't come out of the house. They keep sending another man to go get them. And what they discover in there is that there's like a little support group going on. And one of the things that is happening is people are not just talking about the death of Julia. They're talking about their dog from childhood and their, so I found that scene both unbelievably sweet, really funny, and really poignant. So I wondered, is that an experience that you had in real life? Have you seen that? Is that something that exists in your community? Or are you doing as we sometimes do, which is write the kind of world that we want to belong to, where men are able to support each other and be like that for each other?
I think that the men in this community do support each other in a lot of ways. I've seen it when one of them has had the loss of a spouse or a sick spouse or a sick child or even the loss of a dog. But I think that a lot of that was from my Shiva call experience. Yeah. Just like the way people say, when my mom died, and I think I do it too, although I think you're not supposed to do that. But I think, I don't know, I don't mind when someone said something to me like, oh, when my mom died, I missed her for months. It was awful. It's that kind of empathy is a shared experience. Yeah. And it's not, I don't know. You know what I'm talking about? How some people don't
there's talk a hijacking. About themselves. Yeah. There's a phrase, and there are some grief experts out there that say that you need to let the person just talk about their experience. That if you say, when I had a similar experience, you're hijacking their experience. And yet there are people, you just said it, same with me, where when someone said that to me, I was like, oh, then you're my people. I understand.
Yeah, like your club.
Yeah. So I think there's probably not a universal truth. I do think there are people whose grief about their sister dying 25 years ago is unprocessed and you can feel that. Okay, but we're having a present day loss right now and you're not really letting oxygen in the room for that. You're talking about something that happened a long time ago. I think that's probably who they mean shouldn't do it. But in my experience, I think there are lots of people who are just sharing with you, just saying, I lived through this thing that you're going through right now. And yeah. I didn't want to stay at the Shiva either. And then you feel like, oh, I'm less alone in this then.
And you feel, someone would say to me, I remember someone said to me, it takes 10 years to realize, to really have it sink in that a person is gone. Someone said that to me when I was very young. And I remember when I heard it, I was like, why would someone say that to me? Give me like a 10-year sentence. But then as time went on and I still hadn't really processed that my dad had died. So let's say now I was going into college. It felt so good to know that was normal.
So, yes, it was both. And in the beginning, it was like daunting. But then it also, when you discover actually you live with loss your whole life, it's normalizing for someone to say,
yes,
you'll still feel it 10 years later. When we started talking, you were actually describing something that I find really challenging. So I want to ask you about this. There's a concept in grief and loss work, which is called continuing bonds. So it's this idea that in the early 1900s, when Freud was screwing everything up, he was saying, he and other people were like, when someone dies, you never speak about them again, and you have to get over the death of that person. And then you restore and you come back to yourself and then you're over the death of them. They're gone. Continuing bonds is the opposite of that. Continuing bonds is you had a person who you were deeply attached to who was alive. The task in grief is to figure out a way to keep your relationship and love of them alive, but no longer with a living person. And so how do you do that? It doesn't just have to be with their memory of them in the past, but how do you keep them active? And that's what you said. I learned if I hadn't been able to keep the relationship with my dad or my sister alive, it would have been terrible for me. So I'm curious about, like, how did you do that? Did it come to you naturally? Did you talk out loud to him? Did you write your dad a card every year? Like, how, as a small child, did that show up for you and then inform how you've written this book?
I talked to him, not to sound like a lunatic.
And no, not at all.
Yeah. My mom passed away 5 years ago at the age of 93. Her picture is on the side of my nightstand. And at the beginning, because I was so used to talking to her every day, I would literally say, guess what, mom? This one said this, and this one didn't come to the Shiva call. And I would talk to her, and it would make me feel better because I miss talking to her. Yeah. Now, maybe not as often. I've calmed down with that, but I've always believed it. I think I summoned my father when I needed him.
Yeah.
So if I was scared and I was alone, I remember going for a mammogram once, and I go every year, but I remember one particular time.
Yeah.
And they said, oh, you have to come back in. The doctor wants to see you. And I'm like, oh, now my sister died of breast cancer. So I'm like, oh, this is it. This is it. Guess who showed up sitting next to me the whole time? My dad. So how convenient, you know, that he can show up whenever I summon him. And I felt stronger for it.
Yeah. When you say he showed up, did you feel the presence of him? Is that what you mean? Was it, you know, yes, a man who looked like your dad? It was.
No, I would feel his presence. Yeah. And I do not think he actually showed up. I'll explain my feelings in two different ways. In that situation, do I think my dad really showed up? I think I was just wishing for him to be there, and there he was. But since my mom passed away, I've had a bunch of experiences through dreams and stuff that have very little explanation, except that they were something from a sign from my mom.
Yeah.
And almost like I can't deny it. And in writing this book, I took a 6-week class with this rabbi in London on the Jewish perspective of the afterlife. And I learned so much. I didn't even realize there was a Jewish perspective.
Yeah.
I learned a lot, and a lot of your remembering someone according to this perspective is raising their spirit in heaven, like raising them to another level. So according to this rabbi, like if you go to the cemetery, you're raising their level in heaven. If you are thinking of them, if you're repeating your story about them. And he also claims that 3 generations of deceased people were at every wedding.
I love that idea.
So when my daughter got married,
I love that idea.
I was like, everyone's here. She was crying that her grandmother wasn't going to be there. And I said, she's
here.
Yeah. So
that's,
you know,
so interesting, because I often ask that question, mostly just because I'm curious about it myself. Because when my mom died, there were a whole bunch of stuff that happened immediately, like an unbelievable sunset that was just not typical for the area, pictures of it, a monarch butterfly, which is a Christian symbol of resurrection. Like, this butterfly and I had a minute. I ended up having PTSD after my mom died. So I wasn't really like available for those symbols, but I did see them, but I didn't think they were signs. I just was like, that's so random that those things happened in these moments. And now, because it's years later, I feel like I get signs all the time. And I a little bit hate that. I a little bit want people when they're dead to be dead. And except I also believe in quantum physics and the first sort of law of thermodynamics being that we don't create or destroy energy. So I do believe that there's energy out there. And an interesting thing happened when my book came out. People believe in angel numbers. You know what those are? Like repetitive numbers, like 333, 444, 1111. And they have different meanings. And pretty much immediately I was going to Zibby Owens. I was going to New York to do a thing, and I just checked my phone and I saw it was like 1111. And I was like, oh, that's funny. I never see those. I saw them a lot as a kid. And every single day since, multiple times, I have hundreds of pictures on my phone that I just happened to clock those numbers. Mm-hmm. I don't know what they mean, but I really love the idea that my parents maybe are a little bit closer during this big life event because I certainly have missed them during this big life event.
Of course you have. Who's prouder of you than your mother? No one.
Yeah.
Like a big shock to me when my mother died. I was like, wow, there is no one in this world who really wants to hear every detailed minutia or take pride in every single book the way my mother would. It's just a fact. My family loves it, but it's different.
It is different. And I always said that, like, when I had something either that scared me, my mom was really deeply religious and I am not particularly, and it really was nice to hand over a fear and her be like, I'll get the little old ladies praying about this. And just like, oh, okay, she's going to take care of it. And also if something amazing happened, she just had a bandwidth of, she would listen to every tiny detail that you would never tell another human soul. And also think you were the most magical human or your child or whatever the extension was. Mm-hmm. It makes me think, I really wanted to say that I loved your main character, the narrator who's died. Her husband is who we're really following, Ben. We're looking at him and his heartbreak. And it's so interesting because you don't so much show us their relationship. You show us what their relationship must have been in his way of being bereft. But part of their relationship is that she was his editor.
Yes.
And I have to tell you, as a mechanism, I think this is such a brilliant way to bring in that concept of someone who knows you in a way that no one else can ever know you. That there's a way that he and she would work in tandem, which is like beyond having good sex or beyond putting together a good home. It's actually he's transforming and she's supporting that process. And it did actually remind me also of sort of the parent relationship, that when he is mourning her, and you write this so beautifully, he's not just mourning his wife. He's also mourning this partner in this act that he's not just writing. He is a writer. And the way in which he is a writer is relying on her feedback. I just thought that was it struck me as such a deep way to have a relationship. And I wanted to ask you, how long have you been writing? How long have you been writing about grief and loss? Who edits you? Do you have a similar, is there a Ben in your life who is an editor for you that kind of gets it and helps your work transform?
I've been writing since the sixth grade, when I had a teacher say, would take my short stories, whatever was assigned in class, and ask me to walk around the school and show them to the other teachers and wait outside the door for them to read them.
Oh, so that my God. First,
like, wow. What I could do.
God love the teachers who identify and nourish and nurture us in those. That's amazing.
It's crazy. His name was Mr. Conyers. And this is a funny grief aside. My father died that same year in the sixth grade. Mr. Conyers was an old teacher. He probably retired a few years later. So he had all three of my siblings who are much older than me. And he came to the Shiva and he was smoking a cigarette with no ashtray. He was clicking the ashes into his hand.
Oh my God.
And he like bent down to talk to me and the dog, and he was smoking and clicking in his hand. And I remember being like shocked at the skill or whatever it was that he was doing this.
What is he doing?
From the Shiva for me. It was Mr. Conyers smoking in his hand. But yeah, after that, I lost my way. Went to college, studied fashion merchandising and textiles, went to the Garment Center, and came back to writing when I had my first child.
Yeah.
So it was a roundabout way to get.
And how did that happen? How did you notice that because I think of, at least in grief work, I mentioned it before, I teach this course, I think our creative outlets come and knock back on our door. I think they're there in a really present way for lots of kids. And I think they can quiet themselves down when they're not going to become our immediate profession. But I've met so many people who they're going through a big transition or a trauma, and they'll say to me, it's weird, I pulled my violin out from under the bed. I don't know why I did that. And I'm like, your system needed a way to move this energy. So when you had your first kid and you started writing again, and I've heard some people say, I stopped writing when I had my first kid. I didn't have time. What was happening for you that the writing came back for you then?
It was just time. I was working before I had my child, working full time in the garment center. And I'm like one of those people that dives all in with whatever they're doing. Yeah. So I didn't write. I may have taken one class. Yes, I took a class. And in the class, I wrote an essay about the day my dad died. And it actually was published in Redbook years later. But aside from that class, I wasn't doing much writing. Mm. And it just, I had time. Like when I first started writing children's books, and then I wrote a screenplay, and I sold that screenplay. I took a class on how to write a screenplay. I sold it. And then that's when I became serious about doing it as a living for real. So yeah, it was a roundabout way of getting where I am.
Yeah. And I think there are different times of life that sort of transform us. And so we transform alongside, maybe our work does, but it does sound like you've been high achieving with these things since the beginning, whether that's intentional or not, your energy, you're creating products that people want to be a part of.
Yeah. It's funny from what you're saying about using this as an outlet for your grief. My daughter was very sick when she was in high school, and she first had something called POTS where she would faint. Yeah. Maybe one day she would faint, and she went to the FAME school, the High School Performing Arts, and I lived on the Upper East Side then, and I'd have to scoot like across town, downtown. It'd take me so long to get there to pick this kid up who had fainted, and it was giving her anxiety. She's very light, and she didn't want to put me out.
Didn't want to cause all that trouble?
Yeah. And it was drama, high drama. So I decided to sit across the street at the New York Public Library and I wrote my first book. And I sat there all day until the kid said, "I'm not feeling well. I think I'm going to faint." And I said, "I'm across the street. I'll be right there." And it changed things for her because she didn't need me as much because I was there.
Yeah.
And it let her go to school without saying, "Maybe I should stay home today because I know I'm going to faint and you're going to have to rush out." So it led me to helping her, but it also gave me this escape. And I just sat there, apparently surrounded by homeless people, by the way, which I didn't realize till my other daughter came to visit me and pointed it out. And I sat there and wrote for months, and I wrote a book. And it was a great escape, that book.
That's extraordinary. I mentioned Emma Gray, who wrote a book for Zibby. She wrote a book and Zibby has the foreign rights to it, called The Last Love Note. And her story is not the same, but it also involves the New York Public Library, that she lost her husband, took a trip to New York because he was being honored in New York, and sat down and wrote the first chapters of the book that it took 8 years for it to get published. But the book that is now exploding all over the world and is beloved, but hers is, and she did an event, a full circle sort of event in the public library, which was really extraordinary. Yeah. So I imagine it would be interesting to know how many people surrounded by books and maybe homeless people started a book there. But I really love the idea when we're thinking about, like, how do people grieve and what is the process of grieving? You had loss at such an early stage in your life. And I think the way that children grieve is different maybe than what happens if you experience your first loss when you are 40. But I'm curious about when you look back at sixth grade, which is middle school, it's like a hard time in life. And you have a teacher who has already helped you see who you are. Obviously, the death of your dad is a terrible event. How did you end up being able to either be supported or not supported in that stage of learning what grief is about for the first time, which is not what we want sixth graders to be doing, by the way?
Mm-hmm. My siblings were much older than I.
Yeah.
And I think that accounts for a lot of my support, because my mom really was just devastated. My dad died in an accident. So it was so shocking to all of us that, and he owned a motel in Brooklyn, and that's what he did every day, was go there. And so my mom had to take over, and all of a sudden I was handed a key and come home after school, use this key, open the door. It was crazy.
And
my siblings were all out of the house already because they were older. So between my siblings and then like neighbors, like I remember my neighbor two doors down, she'd say, "Don't eat school lunch. Come to me every day." And I'd walk home with her daughter and I'd eat lunch. It was just a beautiful thing. It made me feel less alone. And then my mom started coming to summer camp with me after that and became a group leader. And I was a camper and then a counselor. Things changed from him passing that supported me.
Yeah.
But it's hard. But I had also had friends who had dads that were always like, we'll take you to the daddy daughter tea dance. Don't worry. Things like that. But in truth, I didn't go. I wouldn't go to the daddy daughter.
Yeah, of course. I get that.
It was too hard.
It's painful. Kind of them to offer, but you can't fill
I wish they didn't have that.
Oh, as an aside, I have literally in my community, somebody was like, I want to have a daddy daughter dance. Some woman I've never met before on a community listserv. And I was like, not only I'll be in support of that. Just so you know, I have multiple master's degrees in child education. So I'd love to hear what you think that has anything to do with our children's education. And then I think we could discuss it. But also, just so you know, I'll fight you until I die.
It's true. It was so
I just was like, I'll fight you till I die. That you her rationale was, I enjoyed doing this as a child. And I was like, that's not a rationale. You are not being inclusive in your thinking about who goes to school and is in fifth grade. And if you would like your daughter to get dressed up and have a dance with your husband, there are many other ways for you to do that. So it doesn't happen at my kid's school because my poor husband, he came home and I was like, hi, so remember how you told me not to attack people on the internet? I'm like, attacker.
You're right. It was heartbreaking.
And again, I think when you are locked in with loss, there was a death of a teenager when I was 9. And so my understanding, like, I had 9-year-old friends that still believed in Santa Claus. And I was like, yeah, guess what? Kids die. It's not fat elves bringing you presents is not the way the world works. And in my estimation is grownups have to keep into consideration all the kids that are in a classroom, not just the kids who are doing the normal, typical developmental thing. That's our job. Our job, right?
I remember in fifth grade, the year before my dad died, I remember this so well. Another girl's dad had died. And I remember how everybody was like, how is she even living? How is she even walking around? All these things. And the only reason I probably remember them is because the very next year my dad died. And the first thing I thought was, oh my God, they're all looking at me that way.
They're saying.
Yeah. And that was like really hard.
Yeah.
That I'm like a very prideful person. And then I'm realizing all these people feel bad for me. And that's terrible. And now even like when I've lost a friend and I see her daughter, I always think, oh, she's motherless. And I know that's how people thought about me.
Yeah.
That I was fatherless.
It is how they thought about you. And that is, there's nothing we can do about how people define us. And certainly for children to grow up and be the one like, oh, that's the girl whose brother died. I want to be known as that's the girl who won the English competition, not that's the girl whose brother died. And the thing about that is, there isn't only just terrible stuff that comes from loss, but when you're fresh in the loss, you will never believe that. But you've written a gorgeous book that is partly informed, unlike any book I have ever read, that is partly informed by your own understanding and experience. You have dialogue between characters that's so tight and so fast and so quick, but really intimate and true. One of the things that children can't stand in loss is when you lie to them. So if somebody had come to you and said, oh, honey, they're not talking about you that way, you just would have clammed up because that lady just doesn't know. I know they are. I heard them. I did it. I know because it happened. And why should I be any different? But there's so much in your fictionalized story that feels really true to the experience of grief and loss to me. I want to ask about the characters that are getting a divorce, because again, I think you could have made them a trope, and they're not a trope. They're not just a woman who is leaving a man. They are a family story. And part of the way that you do that is you introduce us to their child first. Can you just talk about that relationship and the grief and the loss and the endings and beginnings that you put in there? Because again, it's not average in the way that you read it.
Wow, you're really giving me a big ego. Renee and Arthur are the people that got divorced. Yeah. And I loved writing about them. That was another thing that I added in because this was now becoming a female story.
Yeah.
So while Renee was divorced in the screenplay and did, you know, end up hooking up with the strummer, which is not the biggest spoiler alert.
Yeah. It happens in like the first 30 pages.
Yeah. Yeah. And that was in there, but it was never getting into Renee's head the way I did now. And that was a really, it was very fun to get into Renee's head. I once did this produced this reality show, believe it or not, called The Divorce Party, that was going to be on Weinstein TV, and it never ended up making it. But in it, my partner and I interviewed tons of divorcees, because we were looking for, it was going to be like Queer Eye for the Straight Guy,
sure,
for divorcees. And so I really got to learn where their loss came from.
Yeah.
And so I pumped into that. I looked at some of their interviews again, and I figured out how that is a loss of a dream. It's the loss of a marriage. It was a loss for the kid. It's a different kind of loss. And I wanted him to be in a summer of change as well as Shep and Ben, but just differently. Obviously, I wasn't going to have him have another death. Yeah.
I think the interplay, and I'm saying this for the audience, the interplay across the generations of characters and the way in which they are experiencing loss is really beautiful. That Shep, who is much older, has also lost a partner, but lost a partner that they lived a full life together. And then Ben is experiencing this loss, but it's not just a partner. It's also a partner. It's also a business partner and a definition of self that is even maybe more complicated than a spouse. And then the son of this couple that's getting divorced, and the way in which he is thought of so affectionately by people around him, who both, they say things like, "I'm sorry about your parents." And it's not unaddressed, but when they're saying, "I'm sorry about your parents," they're really directing that to him. "I'm sorry you are going through this."
Mm-hmm.
Again, he doesn't have a totally crappy summer on Fire Island. So he does seem a little bit older, and you describe that there's some wisdom that he has developed in the process of going through something. But I think part of, like, when you were talking without calling it continuing bonds, I think part of what you're showing us in the grief world is that not everything awful comes from the bad things. The dissolution of the marriage is not probably ultimately going to be a bad thing for all three of these folks. One piece that you wrote in here that I want to just acknowledge, because again, you don't make it the whole plot point, but you tell us very early on that this woman who is in this marriage is pretty hot. She's super smart. She has the availability to really be a part of the world. She immediately is doing stuff that people are like, "What do you mean she's out there trying to get clams in the mucky water?" That's not who Renee is, but it is who Renee is. But there's a scene where she holds herself back from sexual pleasure that just broke my little heart. That part of what she has not been able to have is something that also she denied herself by staying inside this relationship. And there's a sweetness and a real sorrow. So I just think there's so many layers of, I felt real grief. There's this great little shower scene, and I felt real grief for her in that moment. She didn't know how to surrender to it. And you are really rooting for her, and maybe not rooting against her husband either, which I think that's not easy to do when you're writing characters. It's very easy to villainize one person. You see them interact, and I think you feel the pain of the people that are inside the relationship, and feel the loss that has to happen in order for everybody to be happy. And the reason that I bring that up is that we often talk on this podcast and other places about death as being the thing that we grieve, but we grieve shit every day, experience a loss of something every day. And the thing that we talk about here is that there's energy that's created in the space of a loss. And then we have to grieve that energy out of our system. So then again, whether you mean it or not, whether you were just trying to write me a book that is perfect for me, give us these two adorable teenagers who also, one of them is really looking to lose their virginity. But they, so there's a loss in there. And it's, I love it because it feels so teenagery to me. It's like business. It's, they got to get down to business before anyone's going to college. This particular loss has to happen. But again, part of what you build in this relationship is they are having a relationship that they think nobody is watching and everyone is watching them. The whole community is watching them and caring about them. And I think also maybe rooting for them because they both have some hard things in their lives. And then that layer just expands, which, so I want people to know that this book is also really funny. There are some really funny scenes of things that happened in the beach to people. Again, the way the character of Chef, I was laughing out loud. My husband was like, what are you laughing at? I'm like, I'd have to read you all the pages, but the introduction. You mentioned a couple of times that it started as a screenplay. Tell me about that. Is it a screenplay? Is it gonna?
It's so funny that you just said that, because I was just thinking when you were saying about the loss, was that if I remember correctly, the first line of the screenplay said, it was called Four Corners. It wasn't called On Fire Island. And it said something, and then it said on every, for every corner, it was a summer of loss, which is so funny because
really that is what you're giving us.
And then there's the ball game too.
And there's the ball game. Yeah. I haven't gotten to that plot point yet. Also, you're again, it's written so tightly and perfectly. We hear about that ball game, like on also on page 25, somebody says, oh, we're going to have a catch. And I was like, what do they mean a catch? And then it was like, oh, they live next to a baseball. And then it was like, oh, there's a guy who had a baseball career that isn't, each character has some depth. So you started this as a screenplay, which again, part of what I want to do is have a whole side conversation about all the lives you've lived and all the jobs you've done, all the way that you've done them. But so you started it as a screenplay. So that makes sense to me because it's so visual. Like I could make a, if I knew how to use a movie camera, like I could make a movie of this. I can see it. So
how about that? It takes place on my, at my house, basically.
There you go.
That's why it's so visual. I've stepped every step in this book that they're stepping. I have stepped it. So
yeah.
It's easy for it to be visual.
And so is there still a screenplay component? Is it, did it went from screenplay into a book to be a book? Is it also going to be a play or a screenplay, or can we not talk about those things?
No, I could talk about it because it's very up in the air. So I have a script of it, and the script would have to be rewritten, that script, if I was going to include Julia, because the script doesn't have her as any more than an aside. She's in it, but she's certainly not narrating it. So, but that's no big deal. I would rewrite it. But I've had some interest for a television show, which I was like not understanding at first until, did you watch Virgin River by any chance?
I have watched two episodes of Virgin River. So I know, I don't get a lot of TV in my life, but I know what you're talking about.
It was like this.
Yeah.
So this producer was describing to me how she thought it'd be a great television show because it has that small town feel.
Yep.
Even though it's beach town like Virgin River, and I did just watch it, and I do see that. The other thing is that's going on is that my next book, Seven Summer Weekends, and the book after, which I'm in the middle of writing right now, all take place in the same town.
Okay.
And while there are new characters that are the protagonist of each of them, you visit a lot of the old characters in many different ways. So even though On Fire Island is a book on, it stands on its own, you'll be satisfied at the end of it. The same with Seven Summer Weekends, the same with the third book. If you were to read all three, you would get this whopping story of all of these people from start to finish. Little characters, big characters, you know, they all come back. You could see what they're doing 3 years later, 10 years later from the first book. In that way, it would be a really fun television show because it could, there's three seasons that could start with completely different people and hot focuses, but you still get to see Shep and Ben and all those different things.
That's how Bridgerton works. All the, there are characters, right? But we focus on a different family line.
Yes.
It's very satisfying in that way. They interact with each other. You know who they are and what they do, but we have a different sort of mechanism. Okay, that makes
someone picks up, what?
That makes my day to know that the characters are going to be in the next book, which I'm lucky enough to already have an electronic copy of, and we'll be reading in my on my train up to New York, to actually where we get to meet in person tomorrow. Yeah. But that makes me day. I wasn't done with Saturday. Yeah, I'm going up tomorrow. I'll see you on Saturday. I wasn't done with everybody. It's so beautiful, the moments where, you know, Julia, she has to make her own decisions about how to transition and when to transition. And the prologue afterwards, there's such a nice resting point to it. But I was like, I'm not done with the summer. So the idea that my friends are still out there for me to do more reading makes me ecstatic. I am very
excited. I cannot wait to hear what you think on Saturday.
I'm delighted. This is totally delightful. So we know that you've got other books coming out. How should people know about you, follow you, pay attention? How will they know? How can they get the book? Tell us
the books are sold everywhere. Books are sold, right?
Yes, that is true.
Like to buy books. Seven Summer Weekends is coming out June 4th, but if you want to be my best friend, you could pre-order it today. Thank you, please. There's a big sale at Barnes & Noble next week. So
awesome.
Do it then. My website is janelrosen.com.
Yep.
And my Instagram is Jane L. Rosen. I'm the most active on Instagram. If you really want to see what's going on in my life, that's where you could find me.
That's how to do it. That's fantastic. Yeah. We'll put all that in the show notes. We'll put the link to order the book. And hopefully if we get this out quickly, the Barnes & Noble sale will still be happening. But pre-sale is so great.
Yeah.
It means a lot to all the things for authors to be selling their books even before my pre-sale happened, before there was even a print copy of my book. And I was like, I really hope the words get printed on the page. This has been such a delight. I said to you before we were recording that I spend a lot of time thinking about how people can grieve and grieve in language. And there are a lot of folks out there who have stories that want to get out of them, and for lots of reasons do not want to tell that as a memoir. And so in my writing class, I've been really trying to help folks find great writing, good examples where you can feel the truth. This is not a fake story. This is not bubblegum. Mm-hmm. It comes from embodied understanding of what these characters might be going through. And I loved all your people. I even loved Gabe, the surfer. I just loved the drummer. I loved all the people. And I really just felt the truth of the story inside your writing.
I think that it's a really good thing for you to teach, because like in the shoe story, there's a man in that book and his entire youth journey is my dad's journey. So I weave things in to all my books that are somewhat real.
I am really grateful that you are writing these books. I feel like I just got a couple of Christmas presents knowing that there's more out there that I'm going to get to about these characters.
Oh, I'll sign you whatever you want.
Okay. All right, Jane, thank you so much. I will see you Saturday. Travel safe. Take care. Bye-bye. Bye.